In terms of reports, I'm not sure if there is anything major, but I would say that I've noticed quite alarmingly that a lot of players don't really look beyond the actual business that they're evaluating. And when I say that, what I mean is that they don't look at the industry as a whole. They don't kind of pay enough attention to the competition, to where the industry is actually going.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
So, Mark, I understand you had a conversation with one of our very own, who probably has more experience than most of us combined in terms of owning brokerage firms and being a top advisor as well.
Yeah, within Quiet Light Brokerage, I'm obviously the most experienced broker since I started the company. Been doing this for 10 and a half years now. But Brian and I started off our conversation just kind of reminiscing on his career arc. When you take a look at our little industry that we have here within this kind of online business brokerage firm, and you take a look at the companies that have sprung up and really kind of made their mark on the industry, you typically see that Brian has been somewhere right in the mix of all of those companies in that startup phase. So he's been at this just as long as I have. He's been doing this for about 10 years now, and his resume is impressive.
It really is. And he's been the easiest to work with because he really doesn't need any help, which is pretty great given the level of skill and experience he has. But it's funny with Brian, it seems like every time we talk to him, he's in a different country. He lives over in the UK, but I think the last call we had, he was actually in Cuba and working really literally from anywhere in the world, like the true lifestyle entrepreneur. Did he get into specifics about the companies that he started that are well known in this industry?
He did, yeah, absolutely. And people that listen to this, you guys will know the companies. We talk about the companies. I'll save it for that. And by the way, he was in Costa Rica now when we actually did this interview. So he was doing it from his hotel room, asked me in advance, do I need to shave? Is this going to be video? I said, yeah, Brian, you should shave and, you know, comb that hair and all that. So he did. And the audio, because it's a hotel room, the audio is a little bit echoey. I'll apologize for that. But and then if you're like me, I can't listen through accents very well. We make fun of Brian for his British accent all the time. But what he has in his observations in the industry, I mean, he's seen a lot from a lot of different angles. And so in this, one of the things that I want to tease for you guys to listen to, we talk about the things that he finds exciting when he's dealing with a client. You know, the upfront call, and Joe, you and I know about this. When we have somebody call into us, they are starting to explore that possibility of selling. You develop a really quick sense for what's going to be a good opportunity and what's not. So I wanted to see if I could kind of pull that out of him. What are some of those signals that he looks for right away that makes him go, yes, this is going to be a really nice client to work with?
So the signals are being not just the client, but the business itself that buyers are going to be excited about is what you're talking about.
We talk about both. And I will reveal this one thing. We talk about this so often. The theme just came up again, which is we also have to look at those soft sides. The personality, are you reasonable to work with? Those sort of things just naturally come up. Whenever you talk to anybody who's experienced in this industry, that part comes up.
Let's get right to it. We don't want to give too much away.
Awesome. Let's go. Brian, how are you?
Hey, Mark, doing good. Thanks. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for agreeing. I know you're in Costa Rica right now, right?
I am indeed. I'm going to be here for a couple of weeks, and we're actually traveling a little bit right now. So, seeing a few new places.
We have a game here at Quiet Light Brokerage, which is to try and guess where Brian is in the world at any given moment. If you can get it down to the quadrant of the globe, that's usually pretty good. So definitely a world traveler. You are our European representation for the company because you live over in England, correct?
Yeah, I'm mostly based in England in West Midlands. But yeah, like I said, I'm kind of traveling quite a lot, but yeah, keeping my base there.
I got to ask you a question, completely unrelated to any of this, but it seems as if British people travel a lot more than pretty much any other culture I know. It seems like just popping out to the States for a quick visit is no big deal for most British people. Is this true? Am I just completely stereotyping?
Well, I suppose it actually applies to Europeans in general, and it's probably to do with the fact that we've kind of grown up that way. Because living in Europe, it's never really a big deal to travel to a different country. Because from pretty much any place in Europe to any other place in Europe, you can get in a matter of hours. So, like from Helsinki to Milan, you would have a 2.5 hour flight. So we've kind of started traveling from quite early on. Pretty much everybody who's grown up in Europe, and then I suppose that kind of sets the mindset for later.
Right. I find it fascinating. I mean, if we plan a trip to Europe, it's a multi-month ordeal to try and plan. For you, I just find out I decided to come over to the States next week, or I'll be over in the States. And I'm always amazed. So good to have you on this side of the globe, though. Of course, even though you're down in Costa Rica, I know you'll be up here in the States here soon as well. So cool. So, out of the Quiet Light brokerage team, for those listening, Brian, you've been with Quiet Light now for over a year now, a little bit more than, I think I've been about 2 years now.
I think a couple of years, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of years. So for those of you that are keeping track, which I don't anticipate is too many, but we have a number of people here with Quiet Light. And the assumption is typically that Joe is the most senior or most veteran broker on the team. The reality is, out of experience outside of myself, you have by far the most experience. And in some ways, you have more experience than I do at the Quiet Light team. What I'd love to do is just kind of go over your background real quick as to how you got started in this industry.
Yeah, sure. So I think we'd have to go all the way back to 2007, 2008, something like that. So I think 2007, actually. So I suppose my sort of segue into this was when I first started building some fairly simple, Google AdSense sites and stuff like that. I think that was about, even earlier, actually. So that must have been like 12, 13 years ago. And, I was doing that. So I had a few sites. And then at one point, I wanted to sell one of those sites. And obviously, back then, there weren't really too many options, because there weren't pretty much any brokerages that were concentrating on online businesses. Quiet Light started just after that time. Most of the others started quite a lot after this. There was, however, Flippa, or what later became Flippa, that kind of started emerging. So
it was a SitePoint. It was a SitePoint forums at that time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. It was like an Australian developer forum, and they started a little section that was there for people to buy and sell websites, and that's what later then turned into Flippa. So I found that, and I sold one of my sites, and then I noticed that, hey, there's quite a lot happening over there. And then that sparked my interest, and I started buying some sites. And then what I started doing is essentially, back then the concept of flipping sites was quite, there and profitable. So pretty much before I knew it, what I started doing was I started picking up sites that could do with some quick improvements. And I would do that. I would improve those sites, and I would sell them off, anywhere from a couple of months later to a couple of years later. And that basically got me to a place where other people at one point started reaching out to me, asking, hey, you're doing a really good job. I've noticed that you've got a lot of listings, and you're getting good prices. Can you help me sell my site? Can you, draft the listing copy, sort of guide me through the process and so forth? I thought, hey, why not? So I'll, charge a small percentage and help these people. And it was myself and my business partner back then. And we kind of started doing that to the extent that this at one point became the main thing. So we kind of, for a long time, we never really formally became website brokers. But then at one point, I think it must have been a year or so into it, we decided, hey, that's a business. So we better, turn it into a business. And then that's when we started a company that was then called Flipping Enterprises. Now they're called FB International. So that was kind of the start.
Right. And just to be clear, so Flipping Enterprises was the original version. They've reincorporated and changed significantly since then. But that was back in 2009, I want to say.
2009, yeah.
Yep. Okay. So and Quiet Light started in October 2007, if I remember right. Yeah. So just a few years later. Fascinating. Okay. And then you moved on from Flipping Enterprises to, which one was it? I know you're a co-founder of Centurica, and then you're also part of Flippa. Which one came first?
Centurica was first. So a couple of years in, I think that must have been 2011 or 12. I kind of decided that I've had enough of that part of the industry for a while anyway. And at the same time, I saw a need for sort of buyer education and due diligence services in the industry. So obviously, back then the industry was, and arguably still is to an extent, very, very young. And there aren't really many resources available. And the one issue that I ran into quite a lot when speaking to buyers is that they didn't really have any professionals to turn to when evaluating a web business to purchase. So that's when myself and my two other business partners, Justin Gilchrist and Casper Inspections, started Centurica. That took off quite quickly and was really, really well, I think, well regarded in the industry. So we built it up over the course of a couple of years. And at that point, I exited from Centurica first, and then about 6 months later, the whole company got sold to the guys who currently own it.
Right, that would be Chris Yates over with Rhodium as well. I remember when you started Centurica, I was at Affiliate Summit East with Jason Yellowitz. He was speaking at that conference, and I ran into Chris Kite, who is a friend of ours, and he had mentioned what you guys were doing, and I had heard about you before as well with Centurica. And I remember telling Chris, I said, these guys are absolutely insane. I would never want to do buy-side due diligence for anybody due to liability issues. But one of the many times I've been proven wrong over the years, and the company has done well over the years, and been a very good resource. I know, those that have listened to a lot of our podcasts know that we refer or recommend them a decent amount. I think Chris Yates does a really good job and is a good person. But I remember hearing about you guys at first and thinking, you guys are crazy. Who would actually want to be in that position of liability? But it's a good resource. And Justin Gilchrist, that's a name I remember when he first reached out to me, and I was thinking, oh man, just another person trying to get into this space. Turned out to be a giant in the industry. Justin, if you're listening, we miss you in this space. Feel free to come back anytime you want. So you left there and you went on to another company within the space.
Yeah. So from there came my couple of year deal with Flippa. So I got into a discussion with the guys at Flippa, who back then wanted to sort of break through into the brokerage industry, but with very little success thus far. So what we ended up doing was I essentially ended up quote unquote consulting them for what was supposed to be a year, turned out to be about 2.5 years. And I went there to build out their brokerage platform called DealFlow. So yeah, long story short is we did that. It took off nicely. And by now that part of the company has actually separated from Flippa. And my good friend Jamie, whom I basically hired as the main guy there and the main senior broker, has now taken over running DealFlow and managing it. So they've kind of spun off from Flippa. But yeah, that was another interesting 2 year period.
Yeah, I get asked sometimes how large is the industry that we operate in, and I try to explain to people it's pretty small, but there's good money in it. When I look at your career arc, your fingerprints have been over pretty much every major ebb and flow of the industry that we're in. I mean, you've definitely been around and seen a lot of different changes and influenced a lot of the changes. I know when Flippa was starting their deal flow, a lot of the brokers out there were paying close attention because Flippa had such a large audience, or has such a large large audience still. And so there was a real so a little bit of concern, but also just kind of curiosity. How are they going to change from a marketplace into a brokerage? And been fascinating to watch the changes occur over the years. And then you joined, you left the brokerage industry. I tell people when they want to come on as brokers, to tell them, you know, burnout in this space is real. You know, it's not easy. I tell people, I think the average years or the average amount of time before somebody is just completely frazzled is probably around 5 years if you're really, really good. So you took a break for a while.
Yeah, kind of. So, well, not really for very long, though. I think the time that I had between deal flow and when I joined you guys was probably about half a year, maybe closer to a year. But yeah, I kind of needed a break from this, and also to concentrate on the other stuff that I was doing and I'm doing. It's sort of like I think the entrepreneur syndrome acting up here, that I can never sit still and do one thing. So yeah, that kind of. But yeah, I totally agree with you about the burnout in this industry, and it is very much a real thing, and very few people can last for a long time and at the same time remain sane.
Right.
Yeah.
I took time off. So I was brokering solid without any break for about 8 years. And then I took over a year off before I took on another client. But there's something weird about this space where, like, it kind of becomes an addiction, even after
I keep saying that it's like heroin.
Yeah, it is. There's something just super fun about it when you actually start doing deals and are able to help people. But then once you get into it a lot, you do get burnt out. And Joe and I comment sometimes that, you know, that you're reaching that burnout stage when somebody comes to you with a fantastic business and you feel like it's a burden, like, oh, please, you know, let's make some more money. And you're like, oh, I don't want to deal with this right now.
I think we've all been there. But yeah, the highs are really high and the lows are super low at one stage. So it's kind of like, but it's nice because I think it all sort of evens out, because I can be really burnt out at some times, but at the same time, when I then do a deal where, you know, everything goes nice and smoothly, and I work with people who are good to work with, and you know, I can see that we're helping the seller, we're helping the buyer, everybody's happy with everything, then that's the kind of feeling that very 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 nicely balances out the few negative experiences.
Absolutely. So I want to talk about that. I want to get into that here. And hopefully this will be the real value part for people listening. You know, with your and my experience combined, that's 20 years of doing this. And it'll be interesting for us sometime to see if we could estimate what our total closed amount is between the two of us. I bet it would be a pretty big figure there. But what I want to talk to you about, you know, when you're in this space of brokering and you're advising people every day, it doesn't take very long before you develop a sixth sense for what's going to be a good deal and what's going to be a really difficult deal. So I want to see if we can kind of break out some of those things. And I'm going to ask you this and see if you and I kind of agree on some of these points here. And I want to start with the positives. You know, so somebody calls you out of the blue, or you get a valuation request coming through the website, and you are in charge of it. You get on the phone with them. What are some things that you look for, or if you hear immediately, you know, those signals are going off, this is a great deal, this thing's going to, you know, people are going to love this thing. What are some of those key figures or key indicators?
Well, I think objective stuff aside, such as, you know, what the business is and what their numbers are and so forth, I would say that I get really excited when I talk to a seller who's clearly easy to work with and on the same page with us. And I think I can't really quantify this to a large extent. It's just sort of the gut feeling, if you will, that you and I'm sure you as well kind of just get even after a couple of minutes into speaking to somebody. So I can tell that having probably spoken to over I think 200-300 sellers in the last 10 years, I've sort of developed, like I said, a sixth sense of being able to tell whether somebody's going to be easy to work with or difficult to work with later on in the process. And when I say that, I don't really mean so much the future relationship between the owner of the business and me, the broker, but also that often translates into the relationship between the owner of the business and the eventual buyer of the business. And that's a super important thing because, as you know, Mark, the relationship quality, if you will, between the buyer and the seller is the one thing that can very easily make or break a deal. And that's probably the most important thing when it comes to closing any transaction.
Yeah, I think that that sort of intangible comes down to, at least for me, it comes down to the reasonableness that I see from somebody. And it's when we have a discussion and I want to explain where I see value in the business and maybe where I see some problems in the business, you know, are they absorbing that information? Or are they fighting me with that, with that information, right? So if you say, the trends on the business are kind of negative and we want to make sure that the trends are going in the right direction, if they come back immediately and say, well, you're not looking at the right aspects of my business in order to value it, at that point, I'm almost hearing that they're not listening to what we're saying there and just trying to fight us and trying to convince us into a higher valuation. And, you know, the reality is the marketplace is brutally honest. You know, I could say whatever you want me to say. It's not going to change the reality of the marketplace at the end of the day. So that's sort of, are they there to listen? Are they there to absorb? And of course, I'm there to listen, absorb, and learn the business as well. But I think it's that general reasonableness that's one of those kind of soft signals, right?
And I think this is actually the one thing that unfortunately a lot of people speak to us kind of get wrong, that we're not the people that they need to convince regarding the value of their business, because we're not paying them the money. It's you know, our job to take the business to the market. And as you said, the marketplace is brutally honest. And contrary to the belief that some people have, what we say or in what words we describe a particular business is not going to influence the valuation of the business, because the vast majority of buyers are far more sophisticated than that, and they look beyond the sales blurb, if you will. So there is really very little we can do to influence the value of a business. All we can do is reflect what the market value is going to be.
Yeah, and the one thing I try to explain to people is that our valuation and the valuation approach is a predictive value, and that's it. I had a conversation with a buyer, this was probably a few months ago, where he took a look at a business I was representing and looked at the valuation approach. And he came back to me and said, well, you know, I was looking at this valuation book and I think we should really be using this approach to place a valuation on the business. And of course, you know, being a buyer, he wanted the price lower, understandably so. And so his valuation approach significantly discounted the business. And I had to reply to him. I said, I don't care what sort of formula you use or approach you use. You can use whatever formula or approach you want. At the end of the day, we're just trying to predict the marketplace and what one buyer in that marketplace is going to be able to do or be willing to do for that business. And the same thing with on the sell side is just that. What sort of niches do you tend to like when repping a business?
That's a really interesting question. I think that's changed over the years quite significantly. And interestingly enough, I think if we were to go back about 5 years, then ironically, I hated e-commerce. I really and truly hated e-commerce because it was difficult. There were always issues with stuff like transferring over tangible inventory, et cetera, et cetera. But that has actually changed 180 degrees. And nowadays, I would say that I've grown to like e-commerce. And if we took all of my closed deals, then I think e-commerce has actually easily been the majority, and that kind of adds up with what White Light is doing as well. Because if you look at the industry in general, then you can kind of see certain soft specializations, and for Quiet Light, that specialization is quite easily e-commerce, even though we obviously represent businesses across pretty much all business models and niches. But I think e-commerce nowadays is where our collective expertise and most of my expertise lies in over the last year, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I know our numbers break down to just under 50% of what we do is commerce. So that would be a plurality. SaaS comes in second, shortly behind that. And then we get into the different types of sites that can really break down from there. Completely unintentional. You know, I didn't set out saying I'm going to become, have this soft specialty in e-commerce by any means. That's fascinating. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that when you're doing that initial valuation call are kind of those warning signals or kind of those, oh man, this thing is going to have difficulties. selling. I know for me, I'm super focused on trends. Trends are probably the number one thing I look for, but I'd be interested to hear what you look at and what some of the big red flags you look out for would be.
No, absolutely. I concur. Trends are a big thing. And I think the most common sort of warning signs that that something might be off would probably be either a significant drop in revenue as of late. So if we see the business being stable or growing for a year or 2 years, and then over the last 3 months, you have a sudden drop in revenue, then that certainly indicates that that something is very likely off there. Or in the same vein, if I see a continuous decline over a longer period of time, even if it's a slight decline, then that often also indicates that something might be wrong and there may be some sustainability issues with either that particular business or the industry that the business operates in or something along those lines. And I think apart from this, another thing that is a little bit controversial because it often results in false positives is if business books are really messy, then that can be a warning sign. But obviously that's when we come in, because it's at the first stage is for us to determine whether that's a true warning sign or if it's just somebody who has never really paid attention to keeping clean books and you know, running that part of the business properly, which happens quite often, because in our industry, we often see businesses that have grown essentially out of hand for the owner of the business. They've just started a really, really small business, not worrying about stuff like proper accounting and things like that. And before they knew it, the business has grown tenfold or hundredfold, and that part of the business has been neglected. But in those situations, we always try to figure out what's actually going on behind the scenes and whether those things can be fixed, and if it's just a case of some negligence, or if it's the case that the seller is in fact trying to hide something and doctor the books, which we do come across every now and again as well.
Yeah, the books obviously are something that we focus on first and foremost. And I think for me, it's the messy books don't scare me as much. It's the overly simplified books that scare me. When I get a P&L that's only in Excel and it's a total of 15 grand lines in there, I'm thinking something's not right with this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this happens often as well. I kind of put the two in the same bucket. Maybe I shouldn't, but yeah, they sort of go in the same bucket, because if someone has taken an hour to put down some numbers in an Excel spreadsheet and doesn't really have anything further than that, then that can definitely be an issue. Or I actually saw a P&L just a few months ago where I noticed that for some reason all the revenue numbers were round numbers. I'm like, that's not right. That just cannot be. I mean, unless you have one client or two clients and you charge them $10,000 a month each, then that just can't be the case. And then it came out that I was just taking some approximates, because I don't really track the actual figures. So based on what I know how the month was, I kind of put that down. That doesn't really work like that. So if you want to sell your business, then you have to have the exact figures and know exactly what the business has been doing, because even if a broker exists who is happy to list a business having something like this, then you can be 100% certain that you're going to run into issues the moment you have a buyer, or actually before that.
Yeah, round numbers and P&Ls are always a warning sign. You should never have round numbers, or very, very rarely. All right, I'm going to put you on the spot. I didn't prepare you for this question. But what is one thing that you think buyers need to pay more attention to that they currently don't pay attention to? Or maybe let's put it this way. Out of the reports that a business could offer, what do you think is one report or one thing that buyers really don't look at that might provide more insight into the businesses that they're evaluating?
That's a really good question. I think in terms of reports, I'm not sure if there is anything major, but I would say that I've noticed quite alarmingly that a lot of buyers don't really look beyond the actual business that they're evaluating. And when I say that, what I mean is that they don't look at the industry as a whole. They don't kind of you know, pay enough attention to the competition, to where the industry is actually going, whether, you know, the industry itself is likely going to be growing for the next 5 or 10 years or declining, and sort of external stuff like this. And myself included, actually, when I started buying businesses years ago, then I later on noticed that I was guilty of the same thing. I was just concentrating on that particular business and the trends and the books of that business that I completely started ignoring everything else, everything that was around it. And I got burnt a few times, so I learned. I wish that I learned before getting burnt.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice. Looking beyond, seeing if there's room for growth within the industry itself. I had a conversation with Jeff Hunt and asked him a similar question. And he said, knowing where your customers are coming from, which I thought was fantastic advice. You know, understanding that process of you're looking at a business to acquire a business and you see that it has customers, understanding fully, you know, how are these customers being acquired? So I think those two bits of information might be quite useful. Okay, so we'll bookend this and I'll have this as the last question here for our conversation. You know, what would you say is the one bit of information you see buyers frequently look at that you think is probably not as important as they think it is?
So that's a good and fairly difficult question. I'd say that it doesn't happen very often, but I think the reason why I say this is because of the last few days I've actually had two separate conversations in this vein where I've been asked for things like the company's liability schedule and balance sheets and things like this. And I think that's to do with a little bit of misinformation. So you know exactly what I mean, but just so all the listeners know, the vast majority of the deals that we do in this industry are asset purchases, which means that what you're buying is the website, any trademarks, any Amazon accounts, you name it. But you're not buying the corporate entity, which means that you're not buying any liabilities, you're not buying any entities themselves, any contracts, etc., unless they're transferred over, which is like this because it makes things simpler and a lot simpler to both buyers and the sellers. And this also means that in terms of the information required and in terms of due diligence as a buyer, you don't have to spend your time and money making sure that the corporate entity itself is in good order, because that's never going to be your concern or your liability. So that's something that I've come across a few times just recently. Apart from that, I don't really think there are a lot of things that happen too often. Maybe at times getting a little bit too granular with old stuff is something that I would rather not spend that much time on. Obviously, looking at kind of spot checking certain months or certain periods is something that can easily be very beneficial, because if there's anything funny, then that's likely to come up this way. But I wouldn't necessarily go back to 2015 or 2016 and start asking questions about why was there a small dip in revenue in March 2016, because odds are that the seller doesn't even remember it, or if they do and if they can find out, then that information is really quite irrelevant by now.
Absolutely. Getting to that granular detail years ago can be an absolute pitfall for buyers. And I think there's obviously buyers want to protect against risk as much as possible, as do we. We want to make sure buyers are protected from risk, but you can spend all your time looking for what's going to get you and then end up losing out on the bigger picture sometimes as well. So that part's a balancing act. Cool. Hey, this has been fun. With our team being spread out all over the country and literally all over the world, we don't get a whole lot of opportunities for face-to-face. So this podcast and the video portion, at least, is an opportunity for you and I to have a face-to-face conversation, which is always fun. And whoever's listening can either, I guess, benefit or suffer through that conversation. So, all right, any last parting words of wisdom for the listeners?
Well, not really, but I think if there's anything, then I'd actually like to go back to where we started off, which is if I had one piece of advice both to buyers and sellers, is be a nice person, be good to work with, and that's something that is always going to pay off. If you're making yourself difficult, then any eventual deal is likely going to be difficult as well. But if you keep an open mind and remain realistic, then likely you're going to enjoy the whole process working with us, working with the other parts of the transaction, and everything's going to go nice and smoothly.
Absolutely. I think our listeners have heard this from us before. You know, these are financial transactions, but they're also human transactions. Exactly. You got to get both parts right. Cool. Brian, thank you so much for joining. And we'll be talking. I'm sure everyone that wants to reach out to Brian, you know how to contact him. You can find his contact information on the site. He's got a ton of experience. So I'll offer what I offer for myself personally. And that is, if anybody has questions or wants to run something by Brian, just reach out. You know, we're accessible. We're here to help. And more than happy to talk to anybody who wants to ask us a few questions. Thanks, Brian.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Mark.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.